thirst. Would he ever contain that hunger, that wholeness again? Late that night, he played a series of nothings on an erhu that Kai gave him. Songs broke off and became other songs. Sha Jia Bang sliding into Night Bell from the Old Temple, breaking into a fragment of Bach's Partita No. 6, as if music blew through his mind like scattered pages. He kept on this way, playing the beginning of one piece and the end of another, and Kai lay back and gazed at the nearness of the ceiling. Kai had the key to this room, where the Philharmonic's instruments and record players were stored. But they could have been in room 103, in Shanghai, in the remote northwest or the far south, anywhere with four walls and only the two of them. Sparrow let himself believe they had found their way back to an earlier time. Kai asked him to play, Moon Reflected on Second Spring. And Sparrow played it once and once again, realizing that he could not recall the last time he had heard it. Perhaps on the radio in 1964. After that, it had simply disappeared. He felt a humming in his hands and a renewed, almost unbearable pleasure. By the time professors from the Central Conservatory had discovered the composer of Moon Reflected, the blind erhu player, Aping, was in his 70s. If only you had come 10 years earlier, Aping had famously said, I could have played better. The professors captured 6 songs on a recorder before they ran out of wire. When the songs reached the capital, Aping was acclaimed as one of the nation's master composers. He died only a few months later, and those 6 recorded songs became all that survived of his work. Moon Reflected on Second Spring was an elegy, a spiral of both radiance and sorrow. Kai had other records. Overcome with curiosity, Sparrow set the erhu aside. Going through the collection, he felt like a child standing before a wall of colors. He chose Shostakovich's Symphony No. 5. Kai pushed the blankets under the door to dampen the sound and opened another bottle of baijiu. They lay side by side on the thin mat, the tops of their heads grazing the record player.
Shostakovich was criticized for the 4th movement, Kai said. Do you remember? The Union of Composers said it was inauthentic joy. But inauthentic joy is also an emotion, experienced by us all. The censors are always the first to recognize it, aren't they?
Kai smiled, and time ran backwards. Biscuit. The name came unexpectedly to Sparrow. He had known the young woman in the pale green skirt and flowered blouse. She had been a violinist. She had been the same age as Du Li. Kai was still speaking.
Later on, Shostakovich reused pieces of the 4th movement in his patriotic work, cantatas to Stalin, and so on. Did you know? All those fragments of inauthentic joy. In 1948, when his music was banned, he publicly accepted the wisdom of the party. But each night, after the long meetings, he went home and composed. He was working on his Violin Concerto No. 1, and, for the first time, he hid his name inside the work.
Sparrow knew, but had not thought of it in years. The signature, D, E flat, C, and B, which in German notation read D-E-S-C-H, curled like a dissonance or a question in Shostakovich's music. The 5th was everything Sparrow remembered, tortured, contradictory, lurid, gleeful. The room ceased to exist. The record itself became superfluous. The symphony came from his own thoughts, as if it had always been there,
circling endlessly. Sip by sip, the wine loosened their reserve. Kai said that in Beijing, in 1968, the struggle sessions had started up all over again. Mass denunciations were moved into stadiums. He saw a student humiliated and tortured in front of thousands of Red Guards. For what crime? He said the children of political criminals shouldn't be persecuted, that class status shouldn't pass down across generations. The children of class enemies, like Zhu Li, like Ai Ming. What was his punishment? Kai turned, surprised by the question. He died. When Sparrow asked how, he said simply, "They shot him." Kai wiped his hand over his mouth. "Ozawa has promised to bring a few of us to America. I have this hope." The last time they had been alone, Shanghai was on the verge of change. This small room seemed to Sparrow like a hidden space inside the conservatory. When he left this room, perhaps the door would lead him back to the hallway of the fourth floor, where the walls were covered with posters. He would arrive in his office before it was too late. He would tell his cousin that all things, even courage, pass from this world. Everything passes. But he could not get there in time. When he entered the room, he saw her again, just as she was. Each year, as he grew older, as the Zhu Li in his memory grew younger, as Da Shan and Flying Bear drifted further away, he knew he should let them go. But how could he explain it? The person inside him, the composer who once existed, would not allow it. And Sparrow himself could not erase the composer. The composer wanted to tell Kai that no one, not even Deng Xiaoping, and nothing, no reform or change or disavowal, could return those years to them.
"Sometimes I think of leaving. If you had the chance to go overseas, Sparrow, would you?"
He smiled, wanting to make light of himself.
"Even taking the train to Shanghai during Spring Festival feels like crossing the ocean. I never thought I would grow accustomed to the South, but after all this time, I feel at home here."
When he heard the words spoken aloud, they felt true. Kai gestured towards the ceiling, as if it were Inner Mongolia.
"All the educated youth are going out of their minds, trying to get back to the city. And in Shanghai, they're rioting. There are no jobs."
Sparrow, look at it from their perspective. It would be unimaginable to them that someone could turn down a position at the conservatory.
"I prefer to wire a circuit board than to compose a symphony."
Inside the factory, Sparrow's hands had learned another language entirely. His body had altered. Chairman Mao had not been wrong. To change one's thinking, one had only to change one's conditions. Kai lit a cigarette and gave it to him. They were the luxury Phoenix brand, which Sparrow had never even seen before. Kai lit another for himself, holding it out to one side. The ashes fell harmlessly onto the concrete floor. The ceiling disappeared behind smoke.
"I used to hear music and everything," Sparrow said,
but the sentence hung between them. He did not know how to finish it.
"Dear Sparrow," as Kai exhaled.
He changed positions so that the crook of his left arm partially covered his face.
"I'm sorry for everything. I'm truly sorry. We were all alone, but Julie's situation was the most desperate. We all betrayed ourselves in some way. Not you, but I responded in the only way that I knew how. All I wanted was to protect those years of effort, to protect what I loved. I know I was wrong."
The words seemed to come from a far corner of the room, detached from Kai. We all made mistakes. But can't you see that it's finished now? More than a decade has passed. She always said your talent was the one that mattered, and she was right. What happened to your symphony number 3? It was your masterpiece. It was so full of contradictions, so immense and alive. I haven't heard it in 10 years, but I could still play it. You must have finished it by now.
I can't even remember how it began, he said.
He wanted to ask Kai if he had denounced Zhu Di, but he couldn't bring himself to say the words. And it was true that everyone had denounced another to save themselves, even Ba Lut, even his brothers. Kai's answer wouldn't bring her back.
You loved her too, didn't you?
Zhu Li is gone, he said quietly. Many people are gone. Can't you see?
I don't see.
Kai turned onto his side and looked at him, a beseeching look. He crushed out his cigarette and unthinkingly lit another, unable to bear the silence.
At Premier Zhou Enlai's funeral, he said, I went to Tiananmen Square. I read the posters and the letters people had left behind. I memorized them. Let me tell you, world, I do not believe. I do not believe the sky is blue. I do not believe that dreams are false. I don't believe that death has no revenge. Everyone read them, and I wondered, what happens when 100,000 people memorize the same poem? Does anything change? Around Tiananmen Square, there were so many mourners, hundreds of thousands of workers, crying openly because for a day or two they could grieve in public. The police came and gathered up all the funeral wreaths. People were outraged. They gathered in the square, shouting, "Give us back our flowers, give them back." They shouted, "Long live Premier Zhou Enlai!"
Sparrow wanted to listen to Symphony No. 5 again, to the reflective and reflecting Largo. Shostakovich was a composer who had finally written about scorn and degradation, who had used harmony against itself and exposed all the scraping and dissonance inside. For years, his public self had told the world that he was working on a symphony dedicated to Lenin, but no trace of that manuscript had yet to be found. When he was denounced in 1936 and again in 1948, Shostakovich answered, "I will try again and again." Did the composer inside Sparrow have the will to do this? But if he knew the will and the talent were gone, what good would it do to begin again?
"Sparrow, remember the classics we memorized? The words are still true. We have no ties of kinship or even provenance, but I am bound to him by ties of sentiment, and I share his sorrows and misfortunes. We waited our whole lives, and now the country is finally opening up. I've been thinking, there are ways to begin again. We could leave."
The possibilities before Sparrow, which should have given him joy, instead broke his heart. He was no longer the same person. "I used to be humbled before music," he thought. "I loved music so much, it blinded me to the world. What right do I have, do any of us have, to go back? Repetition was an illusion. The idea of return, of beginning over again, of creating a new country had always been a deception, a beautiful dream from which they had awoken. Perhaps they had loved one another, but now Sparrow had his parents to care for. They relied on him, and his life was not his own. It belonged to his wife, and to Ai Ming as well. And it was true. Factory work had brought a peace he had never known before. The routine had freed him." Kai's mouth was against his shoulder, the skin of his neck. They lay like this, unable to move forward, unable to continue. Kai said,
"What you said is true. I loved her. I loved you both.
There was no shame in that."
"No," he said quietly. "But I was ashamed. We were young. It was a kind of love, only I didn't comprehend."
"If you have the chance to go to America, you must go. Don't let the opportunity pass. After all you've seen, all that's been done, don't turn back. Your family and Julie, too, would have said the same."
Kai nodded. Was he weeping, Sparrow thought? The alcohol and the cigarettes had cleared his head and heightened his desire. There was no need to weep, he knew. They were fortunate. They had seen through the illusion. Even if the country went on, they could never be made to forget. "I loved you both," Sparrow thought. "I love you both."
"I'm sorry, Sparrow," he said. "I would sacrifice anything to be a different person. Please, please let me help you leave."
"No," Sparrow said. Julie is here, he thought. And the composer had long since gone away. Only Sparrow himself had failed to recognize it. But he need only to look down at his tired, calloused hands to know.
"My life is here."
10 years later, at the Shanghai Conservatory, Ai Ming was impeded by every kind of music, trills and percussions, a violin reciting a flotilla of notes. The bird of quiet walked ahead of her, in the new trousers, baby blue shirt, and leather shoes that Ling had given him for 1988 Spring Festival. Her father looked taller. Or maybe he only looked this way because when he wore his usual clothes, the uniform of Huizhou Semiconductor Factory No. 1, Sparrow never stood up straight. Her father ran up the narrow road of the conservatory as if someone up ahead was calling him. Beside her, Balut moaned.
"Ayoh! These young pianists have no understanding of contrapuntal anything. Loud and fast, that's the only thing they know."
"But it sounds good, Grandfather."
"Because you have no ear. You never had one, poor kid."
Which was true. Just the other night, when he tried to give her an erhu lesson, he had screamed at her,
"How can a budding scientist be incapable of keeping 4/4 time? Even a buffalo can do it."
Now Ai Ming took his papery hand. Balut had gotten plump in the belly, but not in the legs, and he resembled a pear on toothpicks. She feared he would totter over and be crushed.
"Hey, you! Little Sparrow! Slow down!" he shouted.
When her father turned, Ai Ming imagined the Sparrow he might have been when he was a boy, a burst of song and a rush of feathers. Big Mother had told her that in the early 1960s, conservatory students had been sent out to the fields to wage war. They played their instruments loudly and dissonantly from morning until night, so that no little birds could land in the fields and eat the grain. Day after day, thousands of sparrows, killed by exhaustion, had fallen dead from the sky.
"Yet another solicitous idea from Chairman Mao," Big Mother had said solemnly. "Who said Western music never killed anyone?"
Something so barbaric would never happen now. To mark the beginning of 1988, Big Mother had given her a New Year's calendar with the words, "Happiness Arrives," written in running characters above the plump faces of the gods of harmonious union. Those words lifted her thoughts as she tugged on Balut's hand. "Happiness Arrives." Pretty violinists
wearing brightly colored dresses, parted around them. She would like to be a musician, Aiming thought, simply to look at them. But no, she had always preferred to dismantle a record player than to listen to any old sonata.
Oh, Balut said. This old fart is running out of air.
Don't rush. We're not going anywhere.
How true. How true.
The bird of quiet remained where he was, waiting patiently, as if he existed in a different dimension from the students zipping past. They were electricity, Aiming thought excitedly. Sizzling electrons. And her father was the electron gate. Or they were time, and he was space. Aiming remembered how, when Chairman Mao still breathed, she had regularly written criticisms of her father. I cry bitter tears, knowing that I am the daughter of a bad element, capitalist Roder. In this war, there are no civilians. She'd been only a kid at the time, so her father had to help her write the tricky characters. When Chairman Deng came to power, criticism like these were no longer so common. She and her father had never talked about them. Now it seemed almost funny to remember that she had called him a snake or a demon, and even a snake demon, that she had denounced him so naturally. He had taught her how to protect herself by hiding inside the noise. Why did we come anyway? Aiming asked. The Shanghai Conservatory only makes him feel bad.
Ugh, it's not my fault. Her father wanted to come. He has old friends here, you know.
But there were no old friends, or none that came out to see him. He went into one building and out another, searching for someone, and she and Balut waited under various flowering trees. Before they left, her father went into one of the practice rooms. Aiming sat on a chair in the corner as her father played the piano. She had never heard him do so before, had not quite realized he was even capable. His entire body, the way he moved, changed. Most of the pieces she recognized from the records. Bach's Partita No. 6, Couperin, Shostakovich. But there was another piece, a complex figure that seemed to disassemble as she listened. A rope of music. A spool of wire. It seemed to rise even as it was falling, to lift in volume even as it diminished. A polyphony so unfathomably beautiful, it made the hairs on the back of her neck stand up. When it stopped, tears came abruptly to her eyes. After a moment, her father pushed the bench back. He closed the lid without a sound.
"What music is that?"
she asked. He turned to her and smiled. Aiming grinned too, unsure. She felt an inexpressible sorrow welling up in the room.
"It's nothing," Sparrow said.
"Nothing?"
He stood up and went to the wall.
"It's mine," he said.
The lights were off, so when he hit the switch, they turned on, and he stared up at them, confused, and flicked the switch once more. The number 103 was stenciled in neat black ink on the wall.
"What do you mean, it's yours?"
"It's me," he said, more to the light switch than to her. "Music I wrote a long time ago, part of a symphony I never finished."
He went out. In the courtyard, the sun's glare faded all the colors.
"I hadn't expected to remember. I was sure that after all this time, it had completely disappeared."
She followed him out, the music circling in her mind. She wondered how many things a person knew that were better forgotten, Her father had looked at the piano as if it were the only solid thing in the room, as if everything and everyone else, including himself, were no more than an illusion, a dream. From the moment she had first looked into the belly of a radio, Ai Ming had known her vocation, to study computer science at Beijing University and to be part of the technological vanguard. Wasn't it obvious to everyone? Computers would one day hold up half the sky. When she made this grand announcement to her family, Ai Ming had been 6 years old. Her father had continued eating, but Big Mother had applauded, saying, "So not everyone in this house is half dead after all." That year, 1977, the competition had been epic. More than 5 million people wrote the university entrance examinations, competing for 200,000 precious places. Chairman Deng Xiaoping had reopened general admissions, and this was the first time since 1966 that university entrants would not be selected by the party. In town, during the student parades, Ai Ming had even waved a banner. The people love the students. How entrancing they were, exhausted from studying, yet defiantly awake. On the day of the exam, the first bells signaling the start of test-taking had brought everything to a stop. No traffic, no noise, no bickering. Even Big Mother stopped shouting at passers-by. Many weeks later, when the results were announced, the university entrants became the new heroes, young men and women who sweated over books instead of plows, who held up not one little red book, but a giant stack of possibilities that teetered towards the skies. Their minds were ever-expanding factories, crunching through raw material and spitting out answers. To get an education, Ai Ming thought, is glorious. To go to Beijing University one day would mean freedom. In 1988, after studying 16 hours a day for a full year, it was finally Ai Ming's turn to endure 3 days of testing on 9 subjects. Happiness arrives, she told herself. The first essay question was, light and shadow, all the variety, all the charm, all the beauty of life is made up of light and shadow. Leo Tolstoy. Discuss. The second was, take inspiration from the philosophy expressed by Run Yuan's poem on Wu Xing. She wrote more than 900 characters on each, and, by the end of the first day, was giddy from nervous exhaustion. The overhead lights were distractingly bright. They made warning signals in her eyes. The exam was followed by an interminable wait, by tears and sleeplessness and tantrums. Her impressive scores got her hopes up. But in the end, although she made the cutoff for South China Institute of Technology, her scores were not good enough for Beijing University or Tsinghua, or her third choice, Fudan. She would not be able to leave the province. All that week, comrade neighbors fell over themselves to congratulate her father and grandparents because Ai Ming was the only one from Coldwater Ditch going to university. The neighbors couldn't understand why Ai Ming was inconsolable, curled up in her room, crying her eyes out. The bird of quiet gave her 2 pieces of advice. Study hard, and it is good to be cautious. They were eating dinner, and Ai Ming, still weeping, said, "Oh, Ba, what's the point in being timid?" Sparrow chewed his barbarian eggplant and refrained from giving her Big Mother's answer. "Oh, you new generation, you think you're so worldly wise. You have no idea the rice is already cooked." Or any answer at all. There had been a time in Ai Ming's life when her father's quiet had seemed like another person in their midst. Quiet was alive, like a toy you could just keep hitting. Once, when she was 12, she had asked him, "The music you used to write, Ba, was it criminal music?" He could only say, "I don't know." That same night, he wrote a new banner for the front door, which read, "May the red sun keep rising for 10,000 years," in calligraphy that was accomplished, but empty, a fixed smile. He might as well have written "joy" on a plastic bucket. Big Mother shouted, "Good question!" Ba Lut whispered,
"Symphony number 7, F minor. Timid,"
and giggled at his elderly joke. He leaned across the cluttered table, wanting to wipe her tears, and instead smeared them all over her cheek. In retirement, Ba Lut was the most content of all. He was forever banging on something or other, and making old-time music. And he made Sparrow play music, too, even though Sparrow said his hands were useless. Ba Lut was such a funny-looking old man, too big for his skinny legs. Big Mother would curse him tenderly.
"I like you more now that I can see you less."
On sunny mornings, they sat outside like a dragon and a phoenix guarding the gate, or like two flowery portraits of Marx and Engels. Big Mother with her pants rolled up to catch the sun on her knees, and Ba Lut with his vest rolled up to catch the sun on his belly. Ai Ming got up to clear the plates. Until the arrival of the university results, 1988 had been a year of prosperity. There had been meat on the table twice each week, and they had a sewing machine, a sofa, the latest red lamp upright radio, and quality bicycles for every member of the family. Ma had her own television. She'd just been promoted to news editor at Radio Beijing and had moved to the capital. When the university results arrived in Cold Water Ditch, Ai Ming realized that fortune had indeed arrived, but had found her wanting. By the time she finished washing up, her left eye was swollen shut from crying. She rejoined Sparrow in the courtyard, where he was waiting with the record player. A few of the neighbor kids were there too, playing cards, their mouths smeared ridiculous with some kind of barbecue sauce. They were squabbling, and she wanted to kick dirt in their faces. It was Sunday evening, the only night she was allowed to listen to Western music, though in reality, all these years, she had only been keeping her father company. Did her father honestly believe she wanted to spend hours listening to the agonizing rumblings of Shostakovich? His 10th symphony made it clear life was hopeless. "You choose, Ba." She only hoped he wouldn't choose Bach. Those uptight fugues made her feel like she was trapped in a barrel rolling down a hillside. Sparrow said, rolling his cigarettes. His special Xinjiang tobacco had a damp earth smell.
"Prokofiev?" he suggested.
"I'll get it." She found his favorite Prokofiev's Violin Concerto No. 1. Inside the cardboard sleeve that had a picture of big-jowled, lantern-faced David Oistrakh. She put the record on. Music seeped into the air, and Sparrow listened with one elbow on his knee. His entire body curved like a trigger. Prokofiev composed his pretty music, as if he had not a care in the world. As a result of yearly gifts from Ling and Big Mother Knife, her father had accumulated one of the largest record collections in Guangxi province, but he still insisted on hiding them. The first thing they did when they got home each spring festival was dig out another part of the floor and bury another stack of music. Her father was paranoid. What kind of life was this? A record was a kind of storage in which music lay waiting. Love letters from Canada stored words that kept Sparrow awake at night. She knew because she had opened the letters and sneakily read them all. But for anything to be alive, it required motion. The current must run. The record must turn. A person must leave or find another path. Without movement or change, the world became nothing more than a stale copy. And this was the trouble with Ba's elegant calligraphy, his patient life. It was frozen in time. His tomorrow would always be, somehow, yesterday. Ai Ming knew she was by nature more impulsive, less patient. In the courtyard now, Sparrow lifted the record player's thin arm and set another album down. Ai Ming had to fight with all her strength not to push the record player over and smash it on the ground. This was Smetana's From My Homeland, and it made Ai Ming so irretrievably unhappy her tears started up again. The bird of quiet paid no attention. She pulled hard on the skin between her thumb and index finger to extinguish the pain in her heart. "Ai Ming," he said. She lifted her head. The music had finished without her noticing. "If Beijing University is where you wish to go, then study for another year and write the exam again." As if she would never be accepted into Beida. She felt such bitterness, she almost laughed. "I requested a transfer to Beijing Wire Factory No. 3, and it's been approved. You know the factory. They make radios and also new mini-computers. We'll both move to the capital and have Beijing papers. Your mother used all her connections. Anyway, it's done now. She's supposed to telephone tonight. That's why I hadn't said anything. When your mother calls, try and act surprised." She stared. Sparrow explained, "The university cutoff scores are lower for those with Beijing residency." Ai Ming knew that, of course. The cutoff was a full 100 points lower, and she would have passed easily this year, if only she'd had Beijing papers. Worse, their province had only been allocated 50 spots at Beida. The deep injustice of the world flared up inside her all over again and made her want to scream. "We can move to your mother's apartment in Beijing, or stay here. It's up to you." Ai Ming could barely nod her head. She felt shame crawling through her body, like an old self-criticism. "I want to go, Ba." Sparrow smiled, delighted. She began to cry again. She felt a debilitating mix of joy and panic. "I haven't been to Beijing since I was a teenager," he said. "Don't be upset, Ai Ming. Nothing is ever complete. It's only a matter of turning one's head, of focusing on a new place. And I wouldn't mind the chance to hear something new. The Central Philharmonic is in Beijing." She didn't know what he was talking about. Her father had turned his attention back to the record player. One record after another was lifted up in his hands and then set down again. She intervened. She chose Shostakovich's Jazz Suites, and the album opened with Waltz No. 2, which was glorious and lopsided and entirely unapologetic. Sparrow returned to his chair. He gazed up at the clouded night. He closed his eyes. When Sparrow said, "It is good to be cautious," in the same sure way he might quote Chairman Deng, "To get rich is glorious," he had swayed a little bit, because these days he was drinking too much. His hands bothered him, a phantom pain he couldn't relieve. One evening, a few days before they were due to move to Beijing, Big Mother asked him,
What are you waiting for? What do you need, my son?
I'm content.
Balut says the conservatory in Guangzhou offered you a position, but you said no. Is it true? Ah, you're so stubborn. I don't know who gave birth to you.
He smiled. After a moment, he said, What could I teach? I haven't written in 20 years. There's a new generation of composers now, better suited than me.
He changed the subject. You should come to Beijing with us.
Beijing? Surrounded by cadres and bureaucrats? Eating dust? I'd rather live in Mao Zedong's coffin.
I fear that would wake him.
Big Mother burped. Carefully, she placed her copy of the Book of Records, still in its shoe box, on the chair beside Sparrow. She nudged it towards him.
Don't wait any more, she said at last, standing up. Swirl and Wun aren't coming home. I don't even know what's happened to Projectionist Bang. And your two brothers, they could be Americans by now, for all I know.
She sighed slowly into the house.
Long, 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 she said. So long is the revolution.
Sparrow remained outside. At last, he opened the shoebox. He lifted out Chapter 42 from the stack of notebooks. Its pages were almost pristine, as if it had never been read before. In the chapter, Da Wei has come back to Northwest China. He and his wife are searching for their daughter, who has been missing for many years. One day, they come to the mountainous village, where all the peasants, cadres, and educated youth are too busy to speak. They are engaged in a monumental task. They have been ordered to construct a great dam. And to do so, they must demolish their local mountain piece by piece. Da Wei and his wife can only stand and watch in amazement. The air is choked with the dust of the ground and the dust of the heavens. The peasants are singing a hymn to Chairman Mao, and when Da Wei's wife asked them if they have seen this girl, the peasants refuse to even look at the photograph.
My daughter would be grown now, a young woman?
She volunteers, but the peasants shake their heads and continue to haul their baskets. Someone answers,
Everything comes to rest at the bottom of the river.
But Da Wei and his wife are certain she is not there. They travel on,
but year by year, the Taklamakan Desert wears them down,
their shoes, their faith, until the photograph, too, disintegrates. Even their tears refuse to last. The hot sun immediately dries them, leaving behind only flakes of salt. Da Wei tells his wife that the time has come to return home, and she answers,
Tell me where our home is, and I'll go.
They want to make a spirit offering to their lost child, but they have nothing, no money and no goods. It is 1988, and on the former Silk Road there are no longer any merchants or trains of camels, and countless villages have been abandoned. They come to a blue oasis in the wilderness, shrouded in mist where birdsong twists between them. It seems like the edge of the world, but in fact it is the ancient city of Khotan, for they have reached the southwestern edge of the Taklamakan Desert. Da Wei thinks of his lost brothers, of May 4th, and now his own child, a girl named Zhu Li. And he wonders if he and his wife are the last to pass through this gate. Where does the future exist? If they continue west, they will reach the disputed lands of Kashmir. Do they turn around or keep going? To which side do they belong? On the walls of a school, someone has copied out a letter or a poem, and the words read, I came into this world, bringing only paper, rope, a shadow. Let me tell you, world, I do not believe. His wife no longer has a photograph to show to strangers, and she simply crouches down against the wall, exhausted. The twisting cascade of her hair has fallen from its hold. Da Wei touches the words on the wall. A new conjunction adorns the sky now. They are the pictographs from 5,000 years. They are the watchful eyes of future generations.
I know she's gone, his wife says. I know it, but how can I let her go?
A young man in the schoolyard is playing music. He's playing a violin, what they call a 小提琴, a small, lifted zither, and Da Wei recognizes the song. Bach's Concerto in D minor, written for two violins. But the man plays alone. The counterpoint is gone, or never was. Da Wei thinks of the duties of a father. There should be gifts of money to see his daughter through the underworld. Oranges for sweetness, silk to cover her. His pockets are empty, and he is ashamed that he has nothing to give her. In this life, or the next. This music, and the great distance it has come, confounds him. He wants to tell his daughter to return home, but the roads have changed, and nothing in this country is familiar. If she turns back towards the cities of the coast, she might lose her way. How can he help her? Why has he been so powerless? Da Wei hears the counterpoint as if it were real, a melody line he knows intimately, having replayed it again and again from the radio station, into the safekeeping of the air. I came into this world bringing only paper, rope, a shadow. In surviving the present, did they sacrifice the future? The world he once believed in has changed its shape once more. His daughter left so long ago, but he himself does not know how to be free.
Help me, his wife says. Help me to let her go.
Sparrow closed the notebook. He heard music trickling from somewhere, a radio left on, a memory. Zhu Li, he said. He listened as the air answered. Ai Ming sat up in bed. She could hear a recording of Bach's Concerto for Two Violins circling through the house, starting and then stopping. When she crept out of her room, she saw her father seated on the floor, his back to her. He lifted the needle and held it there, as if something in his mind could not be decided, and then he set it back again. The first tension of sound, the air that came before the music, seemed to crackle up from the floor itself. Oistrakh performed the piece with his son, and the two violins circled one another, sometimes warily, sometimes harsh with accusation, disclosing a covetousness, but also an immense feeling, for which she had no words. She watched her father, thinking of Beijing and the future. What if everything was unprescribed, she wondered. What kind of world would that be? What if everything, or anything at all, had the capacity to change and to begin again? Chapter 5. From their two-room flat beside the Muxi Di Bridge, in a traditional Beijing Hutong, a maze of alleyway housing, Tiananmen Square was just 15 minutes away. It was only 15 minutes, but still, pedaling down the wide boulevard, Ai Ming felt as if she were lifting off into outer space. Growing up, she must have seen thousands of pictures of the square, but the reality was defiantly modern. Shadowy couples, long-haired drifters, teenagers listening to rock music, singing, "The world is a garbage dump." Small children wobbled by in their padded coats, moving at the same sedate pace as their grandparents, as if they had all the time in the world. Today the afternoon wind had an unkind bite. April could not let go of winter. Her bicycle leaned on its kickstand. Iming sat on the paving stones and gazed proprietorially out into the square. For as long as she could remember, right and wrong had been represented by the party through color. Truth and beauty, for instance, were hong, red, while criminality and falsehood were hei, black. Her mother was red, her father was black. But Beijing, resting place of Chairman Mao, turned out to be softly ochre, and even the colossal boulevards had a camel-colored hue. Red existed only in the national flag and the party banners, but all that red couldn't make a dent in all this yellow. Sometimes the wind brought sand from the Gobi Desert, and the dust got into everything, not only her perceptions, but also her food, so that silky tofu tasted crunchy.
"Come on," a boy whispered. "Don't be like that."
And the girl who leaned on his shoulder said,
"If you like her, just tell me honestly. I'm not old-fashioned. I won't do something foolish."
Iming closed her eyes and pretended not to be eavesdropping. People in Beijing were different, she thought. They were surprisingly dignified. They were more subtle, yet more hopeful creatures. Today was Iming's 18th birthday. She had undone her braids, emulating the city girls. Pedaling down the 8-lane thoroughfare of Chang'an Avenue, she had felt its soft heaviness floating behind her. Yesterday, instead of studying, she had altered the line of her best dress, and now the cotton tugged firmly at her breasts and hips, giving her a feeling of heightened containment. In the center of the square, she looked up at the ochre sky and thought, "Let me tell you, world, I wish to believe." Alone, she did not feel lonely at all. It was as if she walked upon some miraculous circuit board that made her more powerful. But later on, at twilight, when she met her parents at the square's northern edge and they walked to Iming's favorite restaurant, Comrade Barbarian, she began to feel as if her lungs were being crushed. Her mother radiated anxiety, or perhaps only regret. After dinner, when Ling paid to have their picture taken in front of Tiananmen Gate, Iming had a sudden image of what they must look like. Sparrow, the factory worker, Ling, the diligent cadre, and Iming herself, the good student. They even dressed in the bland, inoffensive colors of a model family.
"Don't even breathe," the photographer said. "Hold it! Hold it!"
She fixed her gaze on a point behind his right ear, where three slim boys in matching wind cheaters stood beneath an enormous banner. "Study hard and make progress every day." She thought to herself, "I must make myself fortunate." But what was fortunate? She had come to believe it was being exactly the same on the inside as on the outside. What was misfortune but the quality of existing as something or someone else inside? Since childhood, she had been reading Sparrow's diary, which her father used to write and submit to his superiors every week. Until 1978, her father had been categorized as a criminal element, but with a diary this dull, there was no way he could be a hooligan. Only now did Iming realize she'd underestimated the bird of quiet. Even Big Mother hadn't known about the bundle of foreign letters hidden in a Glenn Gould album sleeve. At first, it had been the stamps that drew her to them, such glorious images of Canadian mountains and frozen seas, such thick Western paper. "Are you writing? Will you send me your recent compositions?
My beloved sparrow, I think of you constantly.
Who was this Jiang Kai, and what did she look like? How was it possible that the bird of quiet had a secret love?
The photographer's shutter made a big clap.
Good, Sparrow said.
Done.
He turned to Ai Ming. There was a tiny piece of fluff on his factory shirt. She removed it.
Ling counted the coins in her purse and gave them to the photographer.
The coins made a clicking like a handful of beans.
Sparrow pointed up to a dragon kite in the air. He didn't seem to realize she was no longer a little child and could not be so easily diverted.
How beautiful.
At home, in the tiny room that served as her study, magazines occupied her. Not the candy-colored women's magazines that had begun to appear in Beijing kiosks, but serious journals such as Let the Natural Sciences Contend. She had an affinity for probability theory and Riemannian symmetric shapes, which she continued to study, neglecting politics and English, which had been her downfall the first time around. One of their neighbors, Lu Yiwen, was a glamorous first-year student at Beijing Normal University. She had given Ai Ming a copy of Miyazaki's China's Examination Hell, the civil service examination of Imperial China. It was thick. Yiwen had laughed and said she didn't need it anymore. Now, Ai Ming glared at her desk and felt the ridiculousness of it all. These high towers of books made a futuristic city around her. She hid inside and dozed off, her dreams intersecting like airplanes in the sky. A voice in her head kept saying, nonsensically, Yiwen is airy like a cloud. The Central Committee of the Chinese Communist Party announces with deep sorrow. She turned, and as she did so, a page of Let the Natural Sciences Contend crumpled under her cheek. She reached out to wipe it off. Long-tested, loyal communist fighter, Hu Yaobang, a great proletarian revolutionary. Big Mother Knife, she muddily thought, used to mutter Yaobang when she scrubbed their only rice pot. The words meant brilliant country, and they also happened to be the name of the general secretary of the party, the disgraced former general secretary. The utmost efforts were made to rescue him. Ai Ming opened her eyes. At 7:53 a.m., April 15th, 1989, he died at the age of 73. Her chair shifted. The scratching of wood against wood seemed to come from her own bones. One shoulder burned with pain, and the other felt loose and long. She thought she could hear people weeping. The crying came nearer. It entered with the rain that was dripping down and darkening the concrete walkway outside the door. Today was Saturday, but both her parents were at work. She walked across the room and sprawled out on their bed, too restless to study, and watched the rain for a long time. When Sparrow arrived home from the factory, he turned their own radio on straight away, even though they could hear the neighbors' radios just fine. He had been caught in the rain, and his wet hair looked sad on his forehead. Ai Ming took a towel and rubbed it violently over his head.
"What did you study today?"
he asked, muffled.
"Everything. Are we bringing flowers to Tiananmen Square?"
He pushed a corner of towel out of his face.
"Flowers?"
"Look, all our neighbors are making them."
She could see into the rooms across the narrow alleyway, and also the rooms adjoining their kitchen, where the Gua family were folding white paper chrysanthemums, the symbol of mourning.
"For Comrade Hu Yaobang. He died today, you know?"
"Hmm,"
Sparrow said. He was tilted over,
trying to expel water from his ear. Now his hair was standing straight up, and he looked like a porpoise.